back when we were still on Pearl Street, I took the sermon time on a Sunday morning to address the question of whether the birth control pill can terminate a pregnancy. The issue on the question isn't, is it designed to do that? But if it fails in what it was designed to do, which is prevent fertilization, and sometimes it does fail in that, then can it end a pregnancy by miscarriage? If so, then this, of course, would be quite troublesome. It would mean that the pill would be what we call an abortive patient, something that would end the life that had been conceived, in this case, preventing a fertilized egg from technically from implantation. And given the position that life begins at conception, no one, especially Christians, should use any birth control method that is or potentially could be killing a newly conceived life. Now, that particular morning, I took some time to work us all through that, explaining how the birth control pill could be abortifacient and encourage members to avoid its use. And my primary source for that came from a book by Randy Alcorn, which we have actually some copies of here at the church. In the congregation that morning were two doctors who later told me that I had accurately portrayed the science behind the pill and agreed with the conclusions that I presented and the exhortation that followed. And this then became a subject that I would present in premarital counseling and would give the couple Randy Alcorn's book and would discourage intensely the use of the birth control pill. Years later, I learned that a number of pro-life Christian doctors took exception to Alcorn's conclusions, accused him of misrepresenting the science, exaggerating certain points, and undervaluing other points. And they claimed that the pill was not abortifacient at all, and Christians should feel free to use it. Now, not having the medical or science background to research this myself, I decided to soften my approach a little bit until I could get the question resolved. And so in premarital counseling, for instance, I would simply give the couple Alcorn's book, encourage them to take his words to heart, but would admit that others disagree and that the jury is still out on the question. But then I would kind of like follow up with, but if there's any chance that it could be abortifacient, then we are obligated to find another method of family planning. Then a few years ago, Dr. Christina Francis started coming to our church and joined our church and asked the great question, what can I do to help? And to which I replied, spend some time on research and get this thing figured out, if you could. And after about 2 or 3 years of her working on that, she met with the elders, I think it was last summer, shared her findings, and we asked her to share the information with the church, which brings us to today. And because we see that there's a need to revisit the question with our folks. Now, to be clear, the question for today is not artificial contraception. That's a whole other subject. Roman Catholics have a position on that, and many evangelicals hold to those convictions that the Catholics have, natural family planning and nothing else. But that's not the subject for today. The question for this morning is specifically the birth control pill itself, and other. They'll spend a little bit of time on other abortifacient birth control methods as well. And if it fails to prevent fertilization, and a new life is therefore conceived, you know, the question is, will the side effects of the pill prevent implantation of the fertilized egg, thus causing a miscarriage, a death? So Christina will address this, and then John will actually come up and follow her with some concluding comments. We may have time for questions, and so if you something is not clear, just kind of register that. We may open it up for questions at the end. If not, then certainly you can approach Christina or me or John or whatever to try to follow through with that. So, Christina, are you ready for this? Christina, you are. I want to be sure I get the name of the organization correct in your role. You are the president. You are the president of the All right, national organization. So yeah, we are honored to have you as a member of our congregation. So you certainly have the authority and the standing to speak on this. So we look forward to your words.
Good morning. Well, Wendell gives me far too much credit because a lot of this that I'm going to present is actually the very hard work of Donna Harrison, who's our executive director at APLOG, which is a much shorter version of that organization. It's much easier to say. So I have to give her a lot of the credit. But Wendell mentioned that some people kind of questioned Randy Alcorn's book. And in full transparency, I have to admit that I was one of the ones that questioned his book and some of his conclusions in his book. I think you'll see by the end of my talk today that I've come around to the same conclusions he drew, but possibly for slightly different reasons. So I just would like to share that with all of you today. I'm going to try not to get too heavy into science and make this an understandable discussion, but like Wendell said, hopefully we'll have time at the end for questions. So do I just hit that? Okay. So first, I'm just going to go through just some brief definitions so we're all kind of on the same page. If you break up the word contraceptive into its Latin roots, it literally means against conception. So really, all contraceptives should prevent conception, should prevent fertilization from ever happening. If this were the case, then we wouldn't have a moral issue, at least when it comes to, are these causing abortions? Are these causing the loss of a human life? If no conception ever occurs, then obviously there's no human life there. But of course, as we're going to talk about today, this isn't always the case. The problem is we do not have a test to test for the moment when fertilization occurs. The only tests that we have are pregnancy tests that women take. And a pregnancy test means that the embryo itself, so already in early human life, has produced enough HCG as the hormone that's tested for to be detected in either mom's urine or mom's blood. And this usually occurs about a week after implantation or when the embryo is around 14 days old. So the only test we have to check and see if a woman is pregnant or if she's been on some kind of contraceptive to check and see if it has failed is this pregnancy test that occurs when an embryo is 14 days old. And so you're going to see why that causes an issue. The definition of a contraceptive really was changed purely for political reasons. And pregnancy became defined as beginning once an embryo has implanted, not once an embryo has been created. So contraception came around really and came into use in the early 1960s. And there was some public outcry that what are these medications doing if you do have conception that occurs? What is the medication doing to the embryo then? And of course, this posed a significant problem for the manufacturers of these contraceptives because that's a huge PR nightmare for them. And so in 1965, the American College of OBGYNs, which is very different from the organization that I work for, and they are also heavily funded, by the way, by the contraceptive industry, came up with a solution to this problem. So they acknowledged that the word abortion was understood to be the ending of a pregnancy and that a pregnancy begins at conception. However, they stated that conception really has no scientific definition. Even though we all know that conception means the beginning of a new human organism once fertilization occurs. And so they decided that they would legally define the word conception as the completion of implantation. And so as you conceive, voila, legally speaking, pregnancy now begins at conception, but conception is an event that takes place 10 days to 2 weeks after fertilization. And so now if a drug or device does not interfere with an implanted embryo, the manufacturer can legally say that it is not an abortifacient, which obviously was a very convenient legal maneuver for them to avoid a pretty large public controversy. So I actually didn't know this for a long time, and I, like many people, would read package inserts and things like that to see, has this ever been found to be an abortifacient? And many of them say no, because they don't interfere with implanted embryos. So Wendell already defined that for us. So when we're looking at different forms of contraceptives, there's really kind of five main points that they can interfere with to prevent a positive pregnancy test, really. The first one is they can prevent the ovary from making and or releasing an egg, so they can prevent ovulation altogether. The second would be they could prevent the sperm from meeting the egg. The third would be they could prevent the embryo from surviving the passage through the tube to the lining of the uterus where it would implant. The fourth would be preventing implantation. And then the fifth would be preventing an implanted embryo from surviving to day 28 of the cycle, which is typically when a woman will have a positive pregnancy test. So really the question is, do these medications allow for fertilization in any case? And if they do, what is their effect on the embryo? So as you can see, if they only work by preventing the first two things, then an embryo is not created, and so we would not need to be worried that this form of contraception is an abortive fashion. But points 3 through 5, if they act in any of those ways, then they are going to be an abortive fashion. And the more points along this line that a contraceptive works, obviously the more effective it is. So if one contraceptive has all 5 of those actions, then it's going to be an extremely effective contraceptive if you're looking at just simply preventing positive pregnancy tests. All right. And then one more science slide, which you guys may not even be able to see the words on this, but I'm going to try not to get into too much detail, but there's a couple different hormones that are at play that I think you really need to understand what they are and what they do to understand what I'm going to talk about when we talk about the birth control pill. So when a woman ovulates, prior to a woman ovulating, her ovary is producing estrogen, which is in play with something in her brain called the hypothalamus, which then acts on the pituitary, which is also in the brain, which causes the release of a hormone called FSH. This FSH then goes and acts on the ovary and causes the ovary to start to develop a follicle. Then what happens is the pituitary also releases a hormone called luteinizing hormone, and this is one that's actually going to be really important. So LH, what happens is you get a huge surge of release of LH, and that's what actually triggers ovulation from the ovary. And then that LH level stays elevated for a while, and this causes continued changes on the ovary for it to produce something called the corpus luteum, which is essentially like an early placenta for that developing baby. So the corpus luteum then starts producing a hormone called progesterone, which is a very important hormone in the sustainment of that early pregnancy. Helps with preparing the lining of the uterus to be ready for that embryo to implant. Progesterone also helps with movement of that embryo along the tube and into the uterine cavity where it should be. And then also helps sustain the pregnancy up until about 12 weeks along, which is when the placenta develops and takes over. So that's hopefully a simplified version, but again, it's important to understand what LH does and what progesterone does because that's going to come into play. So the other thing that's important to understand is in women who aren't on any sort of contraception, what does a normal cycle look like so that we can understand how contraceptives interfere with that? So a normal cycle is going to result in ovulation approximately 60% of the time. So women aren't even necessarily going to ovulate every single time they have a cycle, but about 60% of the time they will. And then if we look at couples who are not using any form of contraception, about 85% of them will achieve a pregnancy within 1 year. So because I said we don't have a test to know exactly when fertilization occurs, so we can't check all women to see how many of them are conceiving, we have to kind of use this as a substitute for estimating how many women are getting pregnant every month. So basically, you've got an ovulation to pregnancy ratio of 60% to 85 pregnancies if you're looking at 100 women. Okay, and so that ratio should stay the same. If contraceptives have no other effect other than to prevent ovulation, then we would expect that that ratio would stay the same no matter what. Okay, so as an example, if you have a certain contraceptive that decreases your ovulation rate to 30%, so half of what a woman would be if she wasn't on that contraceptive, then you would expect that you would have half as many pregnancies in that year, right? So you take 85, divide it by a half, and you get about 43 pregnancies. However, many hormonal contraceptives have a really large discrepancy between their ovulation rate and their rate of expected pregnancies. And so that's where we get that they have to be acting in some other way other than just preventing ovulation. Okay? Everybody with me? Okay, good. All right. So now let's look at the different forms of family planning methods or contraceptive methods. So the first one, I had to put this in there because I just love The Princess Bride, and I felt like probably at this point we would need a little levity in the conversation. So the first method are fertility awareness-based methods, or natural family planning is another name for this. There's many different ones, but these all use knowledge of a woman's cycle to predict when ovulation is going to occur. And then avoiding intercourse during that time so that you don't have conception if you're not wanting to be pregnant. Obviously, there's no risk of death to embryos if you do get an unexpected pregnancy using this method because a woman's cycle continues to function as it normally would. These forms of Family planning can be very effective, but they do take commitment and take understanding, and so the couple really has to be committed to using this. So I'm really going to go from like no chance of killing an embryo to the highest chance of killing an embryo, talking through these different methods. So the next method would be barrier method. So these can be temporary or they can be permanent. So temporary would be condoms or diaphragms. Permanent methods would be vasectomy, tubal ligation, or tying tubes. And then something called EsSure, which is metal coils that are placed into a woman's tubes that cause scarring of the tube so that they scar completely closed. In general, these are going to be safe for the embryo because especially the permanent are such effective methods of preventing conception from occurring. And obviously the temporary ones, if they fail, yes, you can get a pregnancy, but you're not changing the woman's cycle in any way. She's not having any hormones that affect the ability of that embryo to implant. So in general, these methods could be considered safe for the embryo. The one potential exception to that is tubal ligation, where a woman has her tubes tied. Failures for this are extremely rare, so only about 5 in 1,000. And I say failures, that's what we use in the medical field. I'm not saying a baby is a failure, but failure meaning it didn't do what it was supposed to do. So only about 5 out of 1,000 women who have their tubes tied will actually become pregnant. However, if a pregnancy does occur, it's much more likely to be an ectopic pregnancy or a pregnancy in the woman's tubes because of that scarring and damage that's been done to her tubes. And so this then would lead to the loss of life for that embryo. So very low chance of that happening, but it is a possibility, more so with that than with other methods. So now we're going to move on to kind of hormone-based contraceptives, which is really what the bulk of the talk is about. So if we look at hormone-based contraceptives, all of them work primarily by interfering with the release of LH from the brain. So that's that hormone that I said had a surge that caused ovulation and then stayed elevated to cause the development of that corpus luteum on the ovary. So it can affect the LH surge or production in 3 different ways. The first is it can cause very little LH to be released, in which case you're not going to get ovulation. So that would be a safe situation because you're not going to get conception. The second would be that it can allow enough of an LH surge to allow ovulation, but not enough to form an appropriate corpus luteum. So you then get low progesterone for early pregnancy, the lining of the uterus is not properly prepared for implantation, and then you can have the loss of that embryo because the embryo can't implant. Of note, some of you may have heard of a condition that causes recurrent miscarriages called luteal phase deficiency. This is essentially what happens in luteal phase defects. You get enough LH to ovulate, but you don't get enough to form progesterone, make progesterone in adequate amounts to sustain that pregnancy. So this is something that occurs even naturally that we treat women for who have recurrent miscarriages. And then the third situation is the LH surge isn't affected at all. You get ovulation and you get a normal corpus luteum formed. And so then you get adequate preparation of the lining of the uterus, and then the pregnancy can continue to term. So for women who are on contraceptives like the birth control pill who get pregnant and carry a pregnancy to term, it's because this last situation happened. However, that's much more rare than the first two situations. All right. So combination hormonal contraceptives are going to include traditional birth control pills. So this is really the main thing, I think, that Randy Alcorn's book focused on. But it can also include the birth control patch or the vaginal ring. Basically, these contain estrogen and progesterone both, and their primary mechanism of action still is to prevent ovulation. However, when they've done studies looking at women's ovulation rates on these forms of birth control, this is a wide variety, but there's anywhere between a 2 to a 40% ovulation rate on these medications. And that ovulation rate is going to be on the higher end if they're the low-dose birth control pills, which you might have heard about. These are lower in their estrogen dose, so they have fewer side effects. And so that's why a lot of women want them, because they don't have as many side effects. But their breakthrough ovulation rate is going to be significantly higher. However, their pregnancy rate is not necessarily significantly higher. So if we use that previous ratio, that 60% ovulation rate to 85 pregnancies a year, then we would expect this ovulation rate to lead to anywhere from 3 to 57 pregnancies per year for every 100 women that are using these pills. However, the reality that we see is only 1 to 4 pregnancies per year per 100 women. So obviously this is a huge discrepancy. So there must be another mechanism of action that these pills are working to prevent a recognized pregnancy. And again, what is happening here is that you're getting a suppression of that LH and a suppression of progesterone production. So you're not getting that corpus luteum. You're not getting adequate preparation of the lining of the uterus for that embryo to implant. The implantation process is actually really complicated and really intricate, and it's so interesting, I think, but it's basically a communication between the woman's body and that embryo, and it has to happen at exactly the right time, and it has to have exactly the right amount of progesterone, exactly the right amount of estrogen for that lining to be ready to accept the embryo. So anything that interferes and causes an imbalance in those hormones and doesn't allow them to be present in the exact right amounts at the exact right time, that embryo is not going to be able to implant. All right. There's another kind of pill called the mini pill, which only has progesterone in it, doesn't have estrogen. This is oftentimes used in women who are breastfeeding because they can't take anything with estrogen in it. Only about 10 to 15% of women, though, who are on this pill will have complete suppression of ovulation, and at least 50% will actually still ovulate every single month. So this does a really bad job at suppressing ovulation. So that's not how it works. But its pregnancy rate is only about 0.3 to 9% of users. So you have, at best, 85% of women who are ovulating, and you only have a 9% pregnancy rate. Okay, so obviously it's acting, again, in a different way. Other progesterone-only contraceptives would include the implant, which is placed, it's a rod that's placed under the skin of the upper arm. It lasts for 3 years. The current one on the market is called Nexplanon. About a third of users of this will have ovulation, but again, they have an inadequate luteal phase, so they will not be able to sustain that early pregnancy. But its failure rate is less than 1%. And then Depo-Provera is the birth control shot that women get every 3 months. This is actually the only one that causes a really profound suppression of ovulation, so women really do not ovulate when they're on the Depo shot. However, that doesn't really start until after the first month of use. And then after stopping the Depo shot, their fertility or their ovulation can actually return before the effect of the progesterone on the lining of the uterus goes away. So that's also a dangerous time where women could actually conceive, but then the embryo not be able to implant. So all of these work by causing very profound changes and thinning of that lining of the uterus that needs to be prepared for an embryo to implant. And so any embryo conceived would be extremely unlikely to implant or survive the early first trimester due to that inadequate corpus luteum because of the, again, the constant dose of progesterone versus the cyclic dose that a woman's body naturally has. All right, the next category are IUDs, which many of you have probably heard of. There are two main types of IUDs, the Paragard, which is a copper IUD and lasts for up to 10 years, and then progesterone IUDs, the Mirena and Skyla, which last for 7 and 5 years, respectively. Basically, one of the main mechanisms of action for these are that they set up chronic inflammation inside of the uterus, and so it just creates a very hostile environment, basically, inside of the uterus. So that can be spermicidal, so it can kill sperm before they would ever even get to the egg, but it also definitely prevents implantation because you have a very inhospitable environment for that embryo to implant in. Progesterone IUDs also have additional effects that add to their efficacy, but again, are probably not their main mechanism of action. They thicken cervical mucus, making it harder for the sperm to get up into the uterus. They also thin out the lining of the uterus because of that progesterone effect, so you get poor implantation because of that. And then they slow down actually the transit of the embryo through the tube. So you actually do have an increased rate of ectopic pregnancy on progesterone IUDs as well. They actually have done studies. So when I first started in practice, I was placing progesterone IUDs because the literature that I had looked at looked like most of its mechanism was by that thickening of the cervical mucus and its spermicidal action. But they've actually done several studies that have looked at whether or not after intercourse sperm are present in the tubes of women who have IUDs in, and there's a very high percentage of women who have the presence of sperm in their tubes. So obviously the sperm are getting through. These can be used as emergency contraception, so placed after unprotected intercourse. We're going to talk about how that works. And they do not suppress ovulation really at all, yet their pregnancy rate is less than 1%. These are extremely effective contraceptives. So clearly these are embryocidal. And just on a side note, do I have time to give a side note? I'm almost done. Okay. just on a side note, I just came back from a conference that was a Christian conference, which just baffled me at times, but a conglomeration of Christian healthcare groups that are working on an international basis. And this is an issue that is being pushed heavily. One of the sponsors of the pre-conference was the UN Family Planning Association, which is highly pro-abortion and highly pro-contraception. And IUDs are being pushed hard in developing countries because they are very effective contraceptives. And so this is what's being pushed, and women are not being told about side effects. They're not being told that these are abortifacient devices. So just as a side note, this is a big deal on the international level as well. And even within the Christian community, it's being completely accepted. So just something for you guys to keep in mind and be praying about. And APLOG is actually working on that. So there was a contraceptive workshop group that met in 2008 and talked about research on contraception. And this is a quote from that group that I just thought just kind of epitomizes why this has been such a hard subject for me to kind of come to grips with over the years. And it said, "There is sufficient evidence to suggest that IUDs can prevent and disrupt implantation. The extent to which this interference contributes to its contraceptive action is unknown. The data are scanty, and the political consequences of resolving this issue interfere with comprehensive research." So it's really hard to find good research on any of this because there's so many political implications to saying that these medications, these devices are abortifacients, because the manufacturers know that the second they admit to that, they're going to lose a huge portion of their clientele. So, all right. So emergency contraception, this is contraception that's prescribed to a woman after she's had an episode of unprotected intercourse. It is used very widely for rape victims who come in after rape. And then also just, I had women calling as well asking for this. Less so now because Plan B is available over the counter. All of these, though, are capable of killing embryos. The least offensive one when it comes to this is probably Plan B, but it still has that potential. Plan B is basically a single large dose of progesterone, and its least effect occurs after fertilization, so its main effect is to prevent ovulation. However, it is capable still of causing that luteal phase defect, so it is possible that if a woman conceives, that embryo isn't going to be able to implant. The other two are very clearly abortifacients. Ella was just released maybe just a few years ago. It's only available by prescription, but it's a relative of RU486, which you guys know what RU486 is, right? That's the medication part of a medication abortion when women go to abortion clinics. So it completely blocks the action of progesterone. So it can prevent ovulation, but it also can prevent implantation, or it can kill an embryo that's already implanted as well because of its profound effect on progesterone. And then IUDs can be actually placed emergently as well, and IUDs can dislodge an already implanted embryo if it's placed after implantation occurs. So those are very clearly abortifacients as well. All right, so conclusions. The only safe methods of family planning or contraception, obviously, are those that prevent fertilization from ever occurring. Or if they allow fertilization, such as in the case of barrier methods or natural family planning, they have no impact on the uterine lining and no impact on the embryo's ability to implant. So again, fertility awareness-based methods are always safe. They can be very effective. It takes commitment. People have to learn how to do it, but it can be very effective. And temporary barrier methods are always safe. And permanent barrier methods, the safest would be vasectomy because of that small risk of ectopic pregnancies with tubal ligation. And also on a side note, it actually for the patient is much safer too. There's less risk to a man for getting a vasectomy than there is to the woman of getting her tubes tied because of the type of surgery that it requires. Hormonal contraception, really the only thing that I have come to grips with that I would feel okay with someone using is the Depo-Provera shot. However, That also comes with a caveat of you would need to use a backup barrier method for the first month of use because you could still ovulate during that month, and then probably for up to 12 months after starting the depot shot because you could get ovulation but not have adequate preparation of the lining of the uterus. So these are the conclusions that I have come to after Wendell kind of pushing me to soul search on this to be able to talk to the church and after wanting to. I wanted to leave it with just a couple remarks that some of you might be sitting here feeling uncomfortable. That's certainly how I felt after I read Donna's paper because this was a drastic change from how I was practicing medicine. And I've prescribed, I've given out thousands of prescriptions for birth control pills. And like I said, I used to place Mirena IUDs. And so there was a significant amount of guilt that came with that for me, knowing that I probably led to the loss of life in what I did. Obviously, I didn't do it knowingly, and we serve, thankfully, a gracious God who is forgiving. And so, but I just wanted to put that out there because if there's anybody sitting here who's feeling that as well because of having used these methods in the past, obviously, we didn't do it knowing what the implications were. And then also just feeling uncomfortable because this is very countercultural, extremely countercultural, even within the Christian community. To be honest, had a coward's reaction, I suppose, to this, and that I came to this conclusion right around the time that I stopped practicing in the office and moved to being in the hospital where I don't have to prescribe contraception. So it was kind of an easy out for me, but this would be a really hard thing if I was still in practice because probably at least 50% of my patient visits focused on some kind of contraception. So anyways, it's a tough thing to grapple with. I feel good that the science that I presented here and the science that Donna presents in the paper that she wrote, which is going to be published soon, so I'm not allowed to disseminate the paper now, but once it's published, I can make it available to the church, is really solid science based on the information that we have, which, again, is really hard to come by because there is zero financing for this kind of research, and there's zero motivation, really, for this kind of research because of the political implications. So so that's where I'm going to wrap my part up.
Wow, excellent. Thank you, Christina. A few years ago, a young couple who were preparing for marriage asked my assistance in working through their decision on birth control. This couple was firmly committed to the sanctity of life and wanted to be sure they didn't compromise that commitment in their decisions regarding family planning. In other words, they were unwilling to sacrifice an embryo on the altar of convenience. By the way, is this how you live your Christian life? Let's step away from conception for a moment. In all areas of life, are you unwilling to compromise your obedience to Christ on the altar of convenience, or on the altar of pleasure, the altar of getting ahead, the altar of popularity? Or are you keeping the door open maybe just a crack for a little sinful pleasure? Just a little lust, for example? Just a second look? Just a small compromise on your taxes? Just a little cheating on a test? Or are we sold out to Christ, which means forsaking all else in order to stay true to our Savior? Well, this couple that I mentioned knew that some methods of contraception are abortifacient. The big question was, are all methods other than timing abortifacient? They found their rather extensive research to be somewhat inconclusive, but failed to find compelling information that certain types of birth control are abortifacient. So what should they do? Well, since they found the information somewhat inconclusive, they sought help from others. When they asked me, I confessed that it was a topic that I had not investigated recently, but I agreed to participate in their research and see if it would shed any light on the subject for them based on that research. So I joined them in reading a number of scholarly articles written by pro-life researchers. We read a book by a well-known evangelical pastor that I wasn't going to mention, but Wendell and Christine already did, so you know what book I'm talking about. And I listened to Wendell's sermon on the subject that he had done, like he said, about 11 years ago, some years before we had found this church. Then I began an argument with Wendell. Now, while I'm half joking, I'm actually serious, because here's what I discovered from our research. I discovered, number one, that several scholarly journal articles written by committed pro-life Christians, Christian physicians and researchers, this research concluded that while most contraceptives are abortifacient, there was insufficient research at the time to conclude that one particular type of pill was abortifacient. And while Christians might choose to avoid all methods of contraception, there was no evidence to conclude that this method had an increased risk of aborting an embryo. The second thing I learned in that process is that some pro-life Christians can be quite nasty to those with whom they disagree. Sadly, the slander and harassment that these doctors and researchers endured was not very Christian. And it was so intense that they dropped their research, as far as I know, or at least refused to publish anything further. Frankly, I was shocked at how abusively these brothers and sisters in Christ were treated. This was a blight on the church and the pro-life movement. Thirdly, I discovered that this is an emotionally charged topic. One highly regarded pastor and author wrote a book on the subject in which he laid out strong arguments against the use of this particular type of pill. Problem was, his entire premise was an emotional argument. He joined the attack on these pro-life researchers. By the way, Wendell, I think you got your history turned around there. They actually did this research. They didn't say anything about Randy Alcorn. They did their research published it in peer-reviewed articles, and it was later that he wrote the book because he responded to some of what they said. But he joined the attack on these pro-life researchers, though in a much more respectful manner. But rather than provide any refutation of their scientific research, he gave emotional arguments. And then finally, I listened to Wendell's sermon from about 11 years ago, which was a good sermon given the evidence that he had when he prepared it. But I was concerned that it laid a burden on our married couples that we didn't have scientific reasons to require. Wendell's response, "Do your research and prove me wrong." Now, advance forward a few years, and our church family was blessed with a delightful new member, Christina. At some point, both Wendell and I discussed the topic with Christina, and as I recall, she had read the articles to which I referred earlier and had found them pretty convincing. However, upon further research that she gave us today, she came to a different conclusion, as we just heard. So to quote Francis Schaeffer, how should we then live? I believe there are several lessons in this for us. I have five. First, Christina has presented compelling evidence that all medical contraceptives, except possibly the one that she mentioned, can be abortifacient. We didn't lay out this morning the biblical case for the sanctity of life because we've done that many times before. And I think we all know the scripture demands pro-life, a pro-life stance and pro-life advocacy. If you aren't fully convinced from Christina's presentation this morning, then do your due diligence. Do your own research. But not in a vacuum. Do like the young couple I mentioned earlier and seek insight from other mature believers. Talk to Christina. Talk to the elders. And then be obedient. Second, let's be gracious. We will not always agree, but we should always be gracious in our treatment of those with whom we disagree. The harsh words and accusations endured by the pro-life doctors and researchers I mentioned earlier, it broke my heart. This wasn't a case of attacks from the left. This was Christians attacking Christians, and this ought not happen. Third, be informed. Don't assume. Don't be lazy. If there's a question, find the answer. And don't fail to be informed out of fear that the facts might require a change in your behavior, whatever the topic, subject. Fourth, make objectively informed decisions, not emotionally based decisions. Your emotional response should be grounded in objective truth, not the other way around. I wish the pastor who wrote that popular book on this subject had been willing to address the subject objectively instead of writing an emotional treatise. And this doesn't only apply to the subject at hand. We are and should be emotional creatures. Thank God for emotion. But all of our decisions should be objectively based, not on ungrounded emotional reactions. And then finally, as I read the literature on this subject, and again, as I heard Christina's presentation, particularly as she had the image of the female anatomy and talked about the whole process, the marvelous process of preparation, the body's preparation for pregnancy, and the way the egg is then moved to the right, or first of all, prepared to even be able to be implanted, and then moved to the right place, and the way the uterus is prepared at exactly the right time to receive that implantation. What a glorious thing. I was reminded of two familiar passages of Scripture, Psalm 139 and Romans 1. Psalm 139, I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And as I read the article that Christina mentioned that hasn't been published yet, I just found myself just marveling at the glory of the creation that could bring about a birth. But then I was also reminded of Romans 1. In part, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And so I was reminded of that passage as I read this and thought, to think of the percentage of our population that refuses to pay attention to the truth that we can see just in this little, in this great example of God's creation. But they suppress the truth in unrighteousness because they want to say that there's no God. It's inexcusable. God has made himself so clear, and I thank God for it. Thank you, Christina, for your excellent research and your outstanding presentation this morning. It's very, very helpful. Wendell.
Okay, so if you do have questions, would encourage you to see Christina afterwards. You got a lot of time today. All right, but do appreciate so much her work on this and presentation. So we'll dismiss at this time. I'll just encourage you to go in Christ's name, enjoy each other, and serve each other in love.